This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
About the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
And good morning. Thank you for listening. You're listening to the Mighty Boo, KBOO Portland. Coming up in a half hour at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, hosted by Patricia Welch. Today, we'll feature an encore edition of our interview with legendary author Maya Angelou. In her new book, Mom and Me and Mom, Angelou shares the deepest personal story of her life, her relationship with her mother. Hey, don't forget, starting at noon today and continuing until 10 tonight, KBOO will be broadcasting the Waterfront Blues Festival live. Coming up next, though, we'll hear Between the Covers, and that is next right here on KBOO.
July 1st, 2013. Station Navigator Report. Thank you, listeners. We had an overwhelming response to the recent program survey. 1,130 people submitted responses to the question, "Do you want to hear Tom Hartman on KBOO?" 764 people responded yes, that's 67%. 366 people responded no, that's 32%. There were 1,127 responses to the question, "Are you a KBOO member?" 640 people responded yes, 57%. 487 people responded no, 43%. There were responses to the survey left via phone messages, called in by listeners, emails, and given verbally at the station. These responses, split pretty evenly for and against the Hartman Show, were not included in the online results. However, next time we will have a secure way for listeners and members to respond who do not have access to a computer. This was just an information-gathering survey, the results of which are now being turned over to the Programming Committee for discussion. The next meeting of the Program Committee will be Tuesday, July 9th at 6 p.m. at KBOO. Thanks again for your thoughtful comments, suggestions, and remarks associated with the survey and what you think should be aired on KBOO. This has been Lynn Fitch.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Temple Grove means different things to different people. High up in the rain-drenched Olympic Peninsula, it's a grove of Douglas fir trees as tall as skyscrapers and as old as nations. And up until now, it's been off-limits to logging. To Paul Granger, the Temple Grove is a sanctuary that he escapes to whenever he can, and a sanctuary he's duty-bound to protect. To Trace, Paul's mother, the Temple Grove represents the unbroken lineage of her Macaw Indian ancestry. To Bill Newton, the Temple Grove is the raw material for hardwood floors, boats, tables, and toothpaste. It's also his livelihood. I'm Jennifer Kemp, and today on Between the Covers, I'm going to be speaking with Scott Elliott, author of the novel Temple Grove. What is the premise of this story? How does Paul end up in the Olympic Mountains?
The premise of the story is that Paul falls under the wing of an old school monkey-wrenching activist who's sort of disguised as a park ranger in the Olympic National Park and is invited into an action to try to save an ancient grove of Douglas firs, sort of in a disputed area on the borderline between national forest and national park land. And he agrees to do this, and little known to him, ends up having a deeper connection with somebody, the logger, who's involved in getting out the cut in that grove. And then there are a few other strands of the story. Another strand is that his mother is concerned about him, doesn't know exactly where he is, and especially becomes more concerned when the FBI takes an interest in this case.
So you said that Paul is engaged in activism up in the forest. What exactly is he doing? Like, what are his methods?
His methods. His mentor is kind of from the Edward Abbey school of monkey wrenching, and so he's putting spikes in the trees is one of the things that he's doing. He's also prepared to sabotage any gear that he finds there. He throws a chainsaw into the woods and steals some food that the loggers have there. But most of the main thing is driving spikes into the trees, which is something that he has trouble doing when it comes down to it. And as he's doing it, the logger who he comes to meet there hears the sound clinking through the woods.
And so he's not really so much of a seasoned environmental activist at this point.
I see Paul as being naive in this situation. He's not. He loves this place, though. He's fallen in love with the Olympic National Park. It's spoken to him early on in his life. He has a kind of a harrowing experience, even before his memory, of being dropped into the Elwha River from a bridge, and he miraculously survives. And I think sort of deep within him is this memory, maybe sort of like, the earliest rings in the tree, represent a year for the tree. The memory of being dropped into the river, and somehow, almost as if by magic, he survives this fall. And I think that's the first moment of many that lead him to come to really love this place, and to want to protect it at all costs.
Who are the people in Paul's family, and how do they relate to each other and to Paul?
Paul's mother is named Trace, and there are really three major strands in the novel, three major points of view. It's a roving third-person narrative novel, and so Paul's point of view, Trace's point of view, his mother, and his father, Bill Newton. And they don't know their father and son. And so Bill Newton's been gone for about 18 years, ever since he absconded shortly after Paul's conception and hasn't been involved in his life. Paul's mother is, her identity, she's a member of the Macaw tribe, and so Paul is too. And then there's also Paul's stepfather, Tom, who's a ship captain, an oil tanker captain, who captains ships to their doom on beaches in the Third World, especially the Alang Beach in India. Trace makes the decision to be a good mother to him and tries as much as she can to be a good mother after his fall into the river early in the book. And so in that way, it's a novel about redemption. She's trying to redeem herself. And I think a lot of the characters, against the odds, seek grace and seek forgiveness, or try to come to some kind of atonement.
So, okay, Bill is the father. He is completely absent in Paul's life, but Trace is very present, and Tom is somewhat present in his life. I guess, can you get a little bit more specific about the relationship, the mother-son relationship?
Sure, yeah. I think initially, because of the circumstances of Paul's birth, I mean, he's the product of a rape and that happens on the banks of the Elwha River, and that's where he's conceived. And Trace, early on, thinks that she's not going to be able to be a good mother to him. She feels this motherhood as a burden, largely because of the circumstances, and sees an opportunity to rid herself of this responsibility. There's kind of a little bit of a gray area in the moment where it happens. Sort of a wind comes up. She drops him. Immediately after she drops him into the river, she feels guilty and at great peril to herself, goes and saves him. And then carries him back to the trailhead. And while she's doing that, she vows her lifelong devotion to him. And she carries through on that. And there's a lot of difficult times when she's raising him as a single mother and trying to make her own way in the world. And so that's why it's especially of concern by the time he's 18, and he leaves a message on the machine and says, "I'm gone. I can't tell you what I'm doing." Of course, what he's doing is he's involved in this action up in the Temple Grove in the Olympic National Park, and so a lot of the book is her concern for him and trying to figure out what's going on, why. Where exactly he is, what kinds of things he's gotten involved in. And as I said earlier, especially once the FBI comes sniffing around and knocking on her door, she's especially concerned about what he might be up to. She also runs into Bill Newton, the father, who's been gone for 18 years. And as soon as that happens, that sort of brings back some of the charged circumstances of his conception.
Paul goes into the forest to protest the cutting down of the ancient trees in the Temple Grove, while Bill goes up to cut down these same trees. Compare and contrast their attitudes towards the forest.
Yeah. Bill is really loves the work in the woods, and he's very happy to be back. He's come back for his own mother's funeral is the main thing that's brought him back. And as soon as he gets back, he runs into Trace in the supermarket. And sort of falls on a knee and wants to apologize to her. And then at his mother's funeral, he miraculously finds out about this job in the woods as a gypo logger, as an independent contractor there. And so when he gets in the woods, I think he enjoys it in his own way. He enjoys the job part of it. He enjoys the challenges of getting out the cut, especially under difficult circumstances. He is very pragmatic about it and sees that when he looks at the big stand of trees, he sees bored feet, and he maybe sees the timber that can be had there and the other forest products. Paul, when he sees the trees, I think he's inclined to see the thousands of species that the trees support in this ecosystem. It's sort of this pillar of the ecosystem. He's inclined to think about how they're ancient and how they rubbed up against, they were around when, for thousands of years they've been there for so long. And he feels this reverence and a sense of awe and a connection to the natural world through the trees.
You kind of answered that in this previous question, but, you know, just going a little bit further in this line of thinking, place is extremely important in the book Temple Grove. Can you talk about its significance and what writing strategies you use to highlight that?
Yes. It certainly is a novel of place, and that's where it came from. I think maybe before I knew what the story was going to be and what different arcs the characters were going to take, I knew that the place was going to be a character. And I think this registers in a writer from a young age. I think my mother grew up in Port Townsend, Washington. And I've told people that, you know, the genesis for this book, if you want to go all the way back, is when my grandmother ran into my grandfather, literally, in Seattle Providence Hospital. And they And they were married, and my grandfather took a job in Port Townsend. So my mother was born there, and then she wanted to raise me and my brothers, at least having some connection to the Olympic Peninsula. So I think even before the novel comes into focus, when it's ready, that's ready to happen. From a very, very young age, the place starts to register. You know, the smell of lupin in a mountain meadow. You know, just the feel of the mist, you know, near the Solduck River, the rich smell of the wonderful air created by all those conifer needles and other kinds of needles. So I think when I started to write, I had just this overwhelming sense that place was going to be important. And in the novel itself, in terms of trying to capture the place, which I think is notoriously difficult, I've quoted, maybe especially for this place, maybe because of the rain, because of how you sort of have to get in tune with the way the natural world wants to work when you go to this place. It's maybe difficult to capture. I sometimes quote a Richard Hugo poem. He says, it's called A Map of the Peninsula, about the difficulty of capturing it. And at the end of the poem, it says, "Soak the map in rain, and when this cheap dye runs, only glacier and river names remain." And so I was intrigued by that challenge. And I think one of the ways I did it was I have this third person roving narration. And part of it, it's always present on some level, is the place itself is talking, observing things. It's sort of an omniscience, and that comes in every now and then, coupled with a third person limited point of view that gives some interior, especially of the three main characters, Trace, Bill, and Paul.
And so you yourself have a very intimate knowledge and connection to this part of the world. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Spent a lot of time there, especially in the summers. Right, I grew up in Kentucky too, and I think in some ways that might have helped. There's a way in which if you go to a place, if you're not there all the time, I think it sort of awakens you maybe to see things in a slightly different way, or you're aware of the strangeness of a place that you might not be if you're just there all the time and it's completely normal to you. It's just that's the way it happened, because my father is from Kentucky, and so we would go out in the summers. My mom always wanted to get us back to the Pacific Northwest, and so we would spend summers there. We lived there from 1980 to 1981. In Port Angeles, and I lived in Seattle for a while, off and on. Once I started researching the book, I went back sort of pointedly, you know, knowing that I had a manuscript or part of a manuscript, and I lived in a double wide trailer for a while on the Solduck River, and went to places that factor in the book just to sort of soak it up. It was fun research to do, that kind of getting out in the woods to try to figure out how to get the verisimilitude of being in the woods. You know, this chase, a lot of this book takes place out in the wild, and so it was fun to go to places, but also other kinds of research, the Macaw Cultural and Research Center, Resources Center out in Nia Bay. I went there and to the Marine Life Center in Port Angeles, where one of my characters, where Trace works, and to the Forks Timber Museum and other places like that to do some more pointed research. There was also a lot of textual research, too, in addition to reading a lot of Richard Hugo poems and trying to channel his good language about the place, but also other writers who set a lot of their work outside. You know, David James Duncan is one that comes to mind, and Cormac McCarthy, and trying to use every available trick and resource possible to put it on the page.
What did you read by Cormac McCarthy?
I've read everything Cormac McCarthy's written. He's one of those writers whose work I've devoured. And of course, it's not, you know, he's writing early on in his career about the South. And my first novel was set in the South, and then later on he's moved to the border, you know, the New Mexico Mexico border. And some works in Texas. Well, and then The Road is kind of going back to the South, but it's, you know, post-apocalyptic. If I had to, you know, be pinned down, maybe in this book, something like All the Pretty Horses would be maybe a good analog.
And And so you mentioned that you went to the Macaw Cultural Center. So Trace's macaw heritage plays a huge role in how she sees the world. How does this give her a different perspective from the other characters?
Yeah. Well, I think she's a lot more conscious of than some of the other characters. And I think Paul, to a certain extent, is as well as her son, a lot more conscious of the Native American history, and so that comes through. Whereas, and it's not a recorded history. Often, it's she says she thinks of it as being subsumed. It's sort of underneath the official record. And so you have this. For example, you have a lake called Lake Sutherland, and it was named Lake Sutherland because a Canadian fur trapper happened to. A white Canadian fur trapper happened to discover the lake in the mid-19th century. You know, discover is in quotes there. Whereas the Native American story for the lake, it's called Nikita, and it's named for a girl who went up looking for roots and tiger lily bulbs and got lost and died there. And the story goes that a lake sprang up in the place and that birds cry her name. And so there's all sorts of stories like that I did some digging to find out about and wanted to make sure that that was, you know, it's the kind of, I'm thinking of the wilderness. You think it's just wilderness and there's no human story, but once the human interaction begins and humans begin to define a place, there's this kind of palimpsest, you know, there's this writing on top of writing. And so you have these different stories that connect with place. And so I think that's one way in which that defines Trace. I think she's, after what happens with Paul, it seems like a miracle that he survives his plunge into the river, and she feels very guilty about that. And immediately, somehow that connects her to a sense of Native American explanations for the place, the Tamanoways, these spirits who are often associated with strange things you might see up in the forest, and if you encounter them, you can sort of take on their power, but you have to deal with them very carefully because there's some danger involved in it. And so this is, you know, coming from a macaw worldview. I think she's also has this double consciousness, maybe a little bit living out. She doesn't live on the reservation, and I think she's a little bit proud of herself for trying to live off the reservation, but she's also maybe feels a little bit of guilt. And so there's a little bit of tension in her identity. And I think Paul feels some of that tension as well. So those are some of the ways in which this identity comes into play for her.
Why don't they live on the reservation?
I think one of the things that happened with Trace early on is she was, I think a line in the book says that when you live in a place, a small place like this, people can level this sort of double-edged claim. They can say, I know you. This is who you are. And that can be a really good thing, but it can also be a problematic thing. I mean, I think something especially when she leaves the reservation, she's in her teens. And so that can also be something that you want to get away from. And I think she's troubled by the fact that people know her story and know that she had... that she was a victim in the way that she was on the banks of the Elwha River, and that they might tell her story that way. So I think she wants to escape that part of her story and try to define herself.
Both Bill and Tom talk about how the only way to have nice things is at the expense of the environment. What do you think about this trade-off?
Yeah, well, I think it's something that we're faced with quite a bit. And I think that's something that Paul perhaps doesn't think about, and maybe something that he has to learn a little bit from Bill. I mean, I think perhaps he has a naive view of that. I think the novel also posits maybe a different way. A way of being in the world. And it's interesting when people look at the Temple Grove, they think of different things. And I think, as I said earlier, Bill is inclined to think about all the products that come from it. And he wishes upon, you know, his would-be enemies who would stop this cut from getting out. That they would lose the products that they're not even thinking about, perhaps that they're using, you know, things like toothpaste or you know, tires on a car and things like that. So Paul and his mentor Dan are inclined to think about human beings, the best quality that we can put forth is restraint. We can practice restraint. We can stop from doing the turning, you know, a beautiful forest that's very complex into a monocultural tree farm. And I think so I think the book is interested in looking at both sides and maybe asking both sides to take a look at the other side. Maybe one of the best things I've heard from early readers is that they go into the book with a certain orientation, but they were able to consider another side. And that's, I hope that in the course of the chase into the Olympic National Park between Bill and Paul, that they sort of, it starts out being a chase between a tree hugger and a sort of a barbaric logger, and they learn that they're more than that, that becomes more than that, that they sort of transcend these categories.
Definitely. Yeah, I definitely got that sense from that section of the novel. It seemed very surreal. But then something else I wanted to bring into the discussion is, okay, Bill is cutting down trees in the Olympic National Forest. Meanwhile, Trace's new husband, Tom, his job is to crash ships into the beaches on India, which is a very dangerous job. Has the potential to contaminate that ecosystem and the people working in that industry. But he justifies that because it pays for their beautiful house in Port Angeles. Can you kind of like talk about the connection between that side of the story?
Yeah, sure. And I think that's also a way in which the book takes on a more an international scope, although you could go into, you know, how often old growth timber is shipped overseas, especially I know to Japan used to be. He also comes across and has a run-in with Greenpeace while he's doing this, and to point out some of the problems. And yeah, and I think more than a lot of the other characters, he thinks very directly about the price he's paying in order to have this nice house with a very nice view of the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And I think Trace thinks about that as well. It's a catastrophe environmentally. The reason why these ships are taken apart on these beaches is because, in order to do it safely and according to codes in a first world country, it would be a very expensive proposition, and so this is a way that the shipping companies can make a little bit of money, you know, selling the scrap at the end. I think the other thing to say about Tom is he's very depressed about this job, and he doesn't like the bargain. He wants to get a job closer to home. He was involved in an oil spill, and so it's hard for him to find a vocation to engage in his love for seafaring and his ability in it, and find a way to do it without feeling guilty. And he sort of comes to some redemption. I mean, I think through place and through he becomes a painter. He starts painting at the end of the book, but I'm not sure. You know, that's just sort of a shallow balm for the kinds of things that he's done. Paul also has found out what he does and cites that as one of the reasons that he's left. He says, "I'm not on your side." And sort of puts Trace in that position, and she says, "I thought we were all on the same side." And so there's this way in which, you know, you have a family bond that's being put in jeopardy because of this kind of these values, the values that Paul is coming to as he comes into his own as a man, I guess.
Is there a section of the book that you'd like to read?
Sure. Yeah, I'll read. Perhaps I'll read from the opening section. This is I've referenced this several times, so this is from the first chapter, and perhaps just stop me if I go too far here. So this is Trace hiking in with infant Paul at the beginning of the book. She stopped mid-bridge and could not control her trembling as she pulled Paul's dimpled legs through the leg holes of the carrier. Her arms continued to tremble as she held his body over the thin-aired vacancy, answered in vertiginous zoom by river. Mist from the roaring water rose to cool the air. Her fingers and toes swarmed with tingles. She stood for a time mid-bridge, holding him out over the rail in quivering arms, then shaking arms. She tried to make herself release him and could not. Paul regarded his mother evenly. He fidgeted but did not cry. He wriggled his arms and legs, enjoying the increasing warmth of the sun, the coolness of the rising mist. He mouthed some whispery sounds and squinted up at the blue sky, where a few clouds were adrift and evaporating at their outer edges. A plane trailed a white plume, its passengers oblivious in the pressurized fuselage to the drama of mother and son thousands of feet below. When she tried to reposition him, a sudden gust caught him. He slipped from her grasp and fell toward the river, feet first, at a slight angle, away from the bridge, his shadow bumping over depressions and irregularities in the western cliff face as the sun shone over the high eastern ridge to cast it there, and then he was lost in white water. The center of himself, he did not know to call it his heart, was attempting to exit through his mouth. Then there was an enveloping coldness, breath-stealing, a primeval wetness. A burst of wild river, colder than anything he had known, rushed up to meet him and caught him before he could sink to hit one of the rocks. The experience was like a second birth and a life that might include several births and rebirths. Perhaps at the end of this cold, wet birth, he would return to the warm, dark place with a loud, steady beat.
Well, thank you so much for reading that. I think that gives a really good introduction to the characters, introduction to the place and the writing style. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Once again, this is Jennifer Kemp. I've been interviewing Scott Elliott, author of the novel Temple Grove.